And today I'm joined, don't laugh at me, today I'm joined by Gavin James Bauer. You may have heard him before. And we're going to talk about his second novel, Made in Britain, today. So hello and welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me in this stifling office.
But it's very pleasant. I really like your It Will End in Tears poster.
We should describe it, shouldn't we? Yeah, I've got a cork board above my desk with It Will End in Tears.
Which is
apt, I think.
I agree.
I didn't put it there, but I left it there.
Who put it there?
It's the previous occupant.
Oh, wow.
She died. It ended in tears. No, she didn't die. She didn't die. She got married.
Okay. I was about to say I'm really jealous, but then not of her death.
What, of her death?
Of the postcard.
Of her transcendence.
Anyway.
Yeah. No, she didn't. She left them. She left here, so I got this massive office, which was great. And as you pointed out when you arrived, behind you now is a wall of books, which is every writer's fantasy.
I think most people. 50% of people want a wall of books, even if they don't read them. It's like the coffee table, but 50%? Taken to a new level.
How can you qualify
statistics
that?
Statistics are just in my head.
50%?
They're always evenly rounded statistics.
I think 50% of people are more likely to want a plasma on a wall in their office, with multi-angle porn playing on loop.
Or if they're really
day.
Cool, an old film projector that just projects
yes.
images straight
Again,
onto the wall.
I'm eating into your 50% now. Because the person who wants the books definitely doesn't want the other two. There's
Maybe.
No Venn diagram.
I don't know.
There's no crossing over in those demographics.
Possibly. I'll have to do my research again. It may be out of date.
Do your numbers again. Do your numbers again.
Okay. But anyway, moving on. Because
yeah,
we don't want to do that thing again.
What
Made
thing?
In Britain.
We have to cover
where
that
we
eventually.
Don't. Where we don't. Last
questions.
Time, because we didn't like your book before, both of us. We didn't talk about it too much.
Who's the we? Oh, me and you.
Yeah.
Not the royal we.
No.
Well, I liked it.
Are you sure?
Still like it. It's present tense. I still
okay.
like it. I'm still.
Do you like it more than Made in Britain?
No. But that's not That's not so much about a measuring of its quality or whatever that is. How do you know that if you're the author? I mean, you're a bit too close to judge it in that way. But I do know, just in terms of my own instinct, that this is a better book because it was more ambitious, it was more difficult to write. It just, I tried to do things in it that I didn't test myself doing on a first book. I think the first book came out much easier and I just feel like it's a better book, which is a nice thing to feel. I wanted to write a book that I felt was better. I want to get better at writing, which you saw I, you know, had room for improvement and plenty of room to grow, which is good. It was a debut novel and I want to be able to write. I want my second one to be better. So
that's good. I mean, I think the idea of the first one, you're getting some stuff out and then, I mean, yours wasn't like first novel syndrome, you know, where everyone tries to pack absolutely everything in and it's just a mess. Yours
no.
was very clear and to the point, I think.
That's nice to say. Yeah, for whatever it was, for its sins, one way or the other, whether you like it or not, I think it is a realisation of what I wanted to do rather than just me dumping a lot of stuff into a book, which I think a lot of first-time novelists do. But that's not to say their first published novel is like that. It's just they will have gone through a process of writing a lot of nonsense. But it was edited and there was work, and that's what happens when a first novel comes out. It's not you raw on the page.
Yeah, that was going to be my question, actually, because both are quite short. Like, Made in Britain's less than 200 pages. Is it you who's
yeah.
responsible for most of the editing, or do other people
Not at all. I mean, you self-edit as a writer, but, I mean, there's only so far you can go. Anyone knows that, whatever, whether you're writing an email or a short story or a novel, it's the same thing. You edit as you go along, and you have this clear idea about what you want to pack in. But eventually, once you've gone through a few drafts, once you've gone through a few reads, you've checked for typos, you've maybe handed it to a friend or someone who you really trust, eventually you can't go any further and someone has to help you with it. So in the case of Dazed and Made in Britain, they were both edited by the same person.
There is something I'd like to come back to about that, but afterwards, because
yeah.
I think for the sake of people listening, because people might listen,
yeah.
what is Made in Britain about, in case they
That's
don't remember
good, yeah,
from
it,
before?
It would be good if they were listening, otherwise it's just me and you chatting and recording it. Which is strange.
Strange
for
and
posterity,
sad.
Or, yeah, for some other sick to some reason. Made in Britain's just a really straightforward novel about growing up. It's about three teenagers, 16-year-old kids, growing up in what has come to be known as Broken Britain, what I would refer to as home, the north of England. So it's a post-industrial town. And it's decaying and it's waiting for what comes next, and it's what it's like to be a teenager and growing up in a place like that, which is very obviously close to home, pun intended, for me. So that's clearly what it's about. And these three kids know each other vaguely because they all go to school together, but they don't hang out, they're not a gang, and it's their three different perspectives and how they cross over and their stories over one summer. It's their GCSE year, so they do their exams and we follow them throughout the summer. That's why it's short.
And did you decide straight away to have three different narrators, or did that come later when you thought that more that
really, you know, that's a really good question. No one's asked me that, and I think actually that's such a good question that I don't have an answer to it. I've never even considered that. Why did I decide to write three characters?
So it was just in your head from the start, did it just happen that way?
It happened. Russell's voice was in my head. So Russell, Charlie, Haley are the three characters. Two boys, one girl. And Russell's character came to me instantly, this idea of this kind of awkward boy. But at the time of writing notes and just trying to write some scenes down in a cafe or wherever I was, or in my room or wherever I was writing, they were just disjointed scenes, and it wasn't a child or a 16-year-old. It was a young man, I suppose. And eventually I started to just think that that didn't have any authenticity to it whatsoever. And what was coming out of it was this kind of awkward, you know, lost kid, and this clear voice in my head. And as that happened, it just became really obvious to write a book about where I was at the time, because I'd just moved away from London for a winter, and I was back up north. I spent about, I don't know, it's about 6 months up north. It just became really obvious that I had to write a story set in that world, and when I wanted to write about that world, I wanted to write about the thing that most interests me about that part of the world, my growing up, my experience of being a teenager, being 14, 15, 16, and starting to feel like I didn't fit in, or I didn't want to stay there, or I maybe thought I was better than it. And you do, you think, oh, I'm so much better than it, and then you group together with other kids, like-minded kids, and you kind of create your own separate set of fascist rules for fitting in. You know, you have to wear your baggy jeans, or you have to be into skateboarding, or you play basketball. No different to the kind of small town popular kid mentality that you're trying to break away from, where they all wear Rockports and they all play football. So I think that the humour of that and the distance from it that I'd gained over about 10 years was what I wanted to address. I wanted to talk about that experience of growing up, but from a position of seeing all the flaws and how naive you are, and how ultimately it's just very, very difficult to fit in when you're a teenager anywhere. So I wanted to write that story. And it just became really obvious to have several voices, because that gave it a bit more, just gave it more than what I had in the first book, which was a very clear narrative of one person. But I didn't want to repeat that. I wanted to do something more ambitious. And then finally, I suppose I should say that why it kind of goes back to one of your first questions about whether I think it's better or not. It's not so much better or not, but it's plot driven. There are three stories here going on at once, whereas Dazed and Aroused isn't about that. It's about a disposition or a worldview, and it's about, you know, he's a personification of some idea in my head, whereas these three are just kids and they're pursuing different stories. And so I'm telling three different stories, which as a novelist is, you know, what I should have probably done in the first one. But no, I didn't want to do that with the first one, and it was more of a stretch to learn how to write stories and then to write three. So I don't know why, you know, I'm answering the question in such a roundabout way. Why did I do it? I don't know, it was really stupid, because it was very difficult to then make all the stories overlap and fit. And
no, I agree, I imagine it was very difficult, but I do think it's done very well, and I think it's a real strong point of the book, because, I mean, although Russell's interesting, having the three, if it was just him the whole book, I think it wouldn't have maybe been as interesting as the three, and I love how, you know, they cross over and you get to hear a bit about what they think of each other, which is often different to what they, you know, they think they're thinking.
Yeah.
And the other thing I was going to say, and what I liked about this one is it's very, it moves very quickly. A lot of stuff happens an awful lot happens actually.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's never, there's no dull moments at all.
I'm glad you said that.
But I don't know, did that come naturally just because they're young people and,
I wanted to pack a lot in. I had loads of stories growing up, loads of anecdotes, loads of things like that. Hayley refers to one of her, I think it's her first kiss, it's her first proper kiss with her paper boy. And although all the names have changed and that kind of thing, I did a paper round and I remember wanting to kiss a girl who lived in a bungalow, and she would open her window in the morning, all sleepy, and say hello to me. And I had this fantasy in my head, the Russell-esque fantasy, which I was kind of thinking about as a kid. Never happened. That never happened at all. I made Hayley have this experience with this boy, and then this boy disappeared that summer because something happened to him on a football field. And that did happen to someone when I grew up in my school. And so I had all of these anecdotes and stories. Probably similar in terms of Days and Rounds, there were lots of anecdotes that I thought, okay, the fashion world, what was it like being a model? But with this one, it was a much richer experience because it was where I grew up. Whereas modelling was a really tiny part of my life for a brief period that I never really felt was part of me. That place and growing up in the north and growing up in that specific town and that way is everything. It makes me who I am. So you can still hear it in my accent, you know. I speak to my mum and I go even more northern, and it's just part of me. So there was a lot to pack in. And also, you know, why is it so short? I don't know. I suppose in theory it could have been longer, but I didn't think any of the three characters are in and of themselves enough to carry the book. And I think all of their stories overlap and work at the length they are. And I don't think I could justify that tone and the way I speak through those characters for much longer. I think it is what it is.
No, I don't think it ended too soon, because I like that it is set over that one summer and it's sort of contained, you know, but I mean, a lot happens, which is...
Yeah, I don't know whether I'll ever be able to write a novel beyond 50,000 words, but maybe that's the next challenge. You know, if I do write a third novel, what's the challenge? Is it writing just a bigger story? A bigger canvas, a bit of landscaping, which my editor said to me on this one. He says, you don't really do landscaping. And I thought, okay, yeah, because I should jump into the scene. And
what
there.
Is landscaping?
He's talking about setting up. He's talking about just kind of lingering in a place or a setting or a moment and just running with it for a page. And, you know, and I just don't do that. I kind of think, where do I need to be? What's the bit of dialogue that I overheard once that I thought sounded clever that I'm now putting into this scene? What's the sign that I saw on the tube? I'm right there. And so I suppose if I was being generous to myself, I would call that brevity. But maybe it's just a lack of talent.
Let's call it immediacy. It's like, you know, it's all very...
Well, there are different ways to see it. There are different euphemisms for not being able to write with landscape. But there are other novelists can make you and force you to linger on a page and to not resent reading 300 and 400 pages.
That's a difficult skill,
I think. I've got enough in these two books to justify that. They need to be the length they are. So, who knows about the next book?
Okay. Could you tell us about the other characters in the book, just so people have an idea about what's involved?
Yeah, so did I kind of explain Russell? He's, you know, a bit of an awkward misfit and a dreamer. And, you know, he's also supremely naive, and he's not as smart as he would like to think he is, but he's not. He's not dumb. Hayley is kind of the inverse of that, because she likes to think, she wants to fit in and tries to act like she doesn't. I think Hayley's kind of flaw is another different type of naivety. All three of them are naive, as they probably should be at 16. I mean, who isn't? You know, I hate the idea. I mean, I'm going off on a segue, but someone told me that they thought it was more of a young adult book than an adult grown-up title. Which I didn't, even though it was meant as a criticism, I didn't really take it in that way, because they are teenagers, they are kids, and I'm telling it first person, I'm writing first person. So should they be like Holden Caulfield, or should they be like even Joe Dunthorne's brilliant character in Submarine? They're so precocious. I didn't feel like I wanted to write about three kids who were just, you know, geniuses, 30-year-olds trapped in teenage bodies. I wanted to write about really naive kids.
No, I think that's a good thing, though. And I think it's nice just to have one that is...
Which is difficult, because I'm being disingenuous then, because I know not only what's coming as the god figure here, but I'm also kind of writing naivety, which is I suppose that's a bit difficult to set up and to consciously do. It only works if you kind of genuinely feel like you know the character, and obviously they're my invention, so I got very close to all three of them and felt like they were a really big part of me, which is great. That's what I did with Alex in Days and Arouse. I felt like I was kind of getting rid of him from me. And these three are similar. So Hayley is, you know, she's just this really sweet girl who's got a wonderful dad who would do anything for her. But she completely misplaces a and misprioritises situations. She just doesn't realise that if she's just herself, which is such a cliche, but if she just, you know, if she's just herself, she would just get on okay. And I don't think she's happy with just being okay. She aspires to bigger things than she's capable of achieving. And she does it in a way that is reckless and ultimately leaves her in a place where she's not only hurt physically but emotionally, and she upsets people around her, most importantly her dad. So she's a difficult one. She was hard to write as well, because I'm a boy, so it's hard to write a girl like that. I don't know whether other authors have that same issue, but writing a teenage girl is unbelievably hard.
I was going to ask you about
that. You know, that was hard. Charlie is a different kind of naive, another kind. He's really hard. He's really kind of sure of himself on the surface. He's popular, but he doesn't believe in himself. I mean, that's what it comes down to. And then he just makes bad choice after bad choice. And he thinks, because he's got a pair of fists and he thinks he's a bit smart, he thinks he can just get out of that situation. He does not realise what... He doesn't see coming what is so obvious from the first few pages when these dead bodies are turning up. You know, he's dealing with people who are actually willing to kill other people. And he doesn't seem to think that, I wonder if, you know, maybe getting involved with these guys is going to backfire. He just doesn't think it. And that's partly, I think, because of his lack of belief in himself anyway. It's almost this kind of, at one point he says fuck 'em about people describing the underclass, which I love that line about how he says, you know, people say that it's broken around here and we're the underclass, and you know what I think, fuck 'em. He says that, but really he's really directing that at himself, and that's what's almost tragic, I suppose, about Charlie. They all have a bit of tragedy, shades of tragedy, all three characters. Hayley's is her ultimate, you know, the denouement for her story. Charlie's is where he is at the end, and kind of the sense of, you know, you feeling like he could have done so much more. And Russell is that kind of bittersweet thing, without giving too much of the book away. But all of them have that shades of naivety and shades of tragedy.
And was there much research involved for like the characters themselves and some of the situations they get themselves into? I can't imagine you would have got yourself into all of those situations yourself, or is it sort of people that you used to know who gave you some ideas? Or
growing up where I grew up, it's pretty all of that's just there. You know, it's really not hidden from view. I mean, the headless bodies turning up, I remember that vividly from school. I remember that being on the front page of the paper, and it being a running story for a while, and it's just stuck with me. You know, this idea of this headless man turning up where someone had, you know, used a shotgun at point blank range and stuff like that, you know, and the drugs side of where I'm from. I mean, the race riots 10 years ago this summer were in Oldham and Bradford and also Burnley, and of all of those towns, the official reports, you know, they came to the same conclusion with the exception of Burnley, which made a big issue of the drug gangs exploiting some little bit of a spark, little bit of violence for their own ends. And so it's pretty common knowledge, and has been ever since I've, you know, been old enough to kind of get it and see that stuff's going on. So it wasn't a giant leap for me to start to kind of sketch out these people hanging out, you know, downstairs in a gym and driving these BMWs around. It's not, it didn't feel like a massive leap, because it felt like that's what I grew up with. It didn't take a lot of research. That the research or the thinking and the difficulties came from trying to write about teenagers, trying to write with a sense of vernacular and dialect without overdoing, you know, the how the youth speak. Because I've just said youth. I mean, who says that? You know, I couldn't have pulled that off. And then also, even if I tried to, it dates the book. So if I put a lot of jargon in there that kids are using now on the street, it dates within a few years, and it just looks really forced. And so what I wanted to try and do is just think about how kids speak. And so when I spent time up there, I would listen to people speaking on the bus. There's a conversation about a football game, FIFA, you know, the computer game. And that is word for word what these kids were talking about. And I thought, that's exactly how kids talk. That's how they talk. It's not the little words that they use for a particular thing, the kind of catchphrases or the jargon. It's how they talk about something so simple as a computer game and think it's proper amazing that the characters can slide for ages. You know, that's what a kid is. It's kind of, so that took a lot of thought and refining and working. It was more in the rewriting that the work really came in, because three stories, three narrators it all making sense, and having moments, certain chapters, where Russell sounded like Charlie, or Charlie said something that I thought, no, that's not Charlie, that's a bit more Haley, isn't it? And that was very difficult. Yeah, that goes back to the question of editing. You really, you do need someone who's going to be quite brutal and challenge you on every single page, challenge you on every line, especially when it's 50,000 words, because every word should count. And if one of them or a sentence doesn't stand up and you can't defend it, then you're a bit stuck, because you haven't got 100,000 words. You haven't got a masterpiece to fall back on and say, well, it's only a line, isn't it?
How difficult was it when you're writing, yeah, with these three voices? Because obviously they fall into certain sort of archetypes, not strictly, but you know, you've got like the shy boy, hard guy, and the sort of, Haley's kind of the quiet-ish girl as well. I mean, how do you keep it so you felt like they really were just individuals and you weren't just falling back on sort of
that
normal people?
That's
normal
part types. And parcel of what I was saying about being challenged on every line. You do that a bit yourself, but when an editor or an agent or someone who's going to be brutal challenges you on it, you know, you have to be able to defend that, you know, this character is an authentic kind of, you know, rounded thing. And I just felt like all three of them were, I liked all three of them. I really liked, I do like all three characters so much that I couldn't envisage that they were archetypes, because I felt like they, all three of them had at least, you know, three or four things that made them not a stereotype and made them interesting and made them like kids I knew. And so, yeah, it could have been really simple. I mean, Charlie has an abusive home to come home to. That could have been it. It could have been like drunk dad, you know, and that's all he is, and Charlie's just, you know, hard. But Charlie has a completely different side to him, which he reveals right from page one. You know, straight away there's a gentleness to Charlie that if he was just a thug, or I was writing him as the hard boy at school, I couldn't have had that in, because the hard boy at my school wasn't like that. So I had to, you know, I wanted to make him something a bit more interesting. And also, really, I put a bit of me into all three of them, so that, again, I know they can't be an archetype, because they're me, you know, they're kind of me with their own voice. And Russell, the thing I was talking about, the Paperboy story, the fact that that's my awkwardness, but I wasn't like Russell. But was I like Charlie? No, I wasn't hard, but I played football, so I kind of had that side of the popularity thing, but then I was missing it on the other side. And so all three of them are different versions of my awkward growing up. Hayley wants to lose her virginity, but doesn't. Wants to hold on to it, wants to wait for someone she actually really likes, but then starts to trade on it and thinks she can get better GCSEs for it. There's a real pull in her to kind of go, do I give it up or do I not? What am I doing? And I was like that. I was like that at 15, 16, because that's peer pressure for you. I didn't have sex until I was 18 and 51 weeks old. So when I was growing up at 15, 16, and some of my mates, I know, a week before my 19th birthday. Wow. So I felt that pull, and that went straight into Haley's character. The other two, you don't really sense that. Obviously, Charlie's, you know, shaggy for England. And Russell, he's just got the awkwardness. He doesn't ever have the, I'm being peer pressured into losing my virginity, because, frankly, he doesn't have any mates.
Yeah, he doesn't have any peers, does he?
Exactly. His is a different kind of pressure. Poor Russell.
When we spoke before, and you won't remember this because it was a long time ago, and I listened to it earlier. Just the bit where you were talking about this book, so I could remember that. And you said that you wrote this a long time ago, and it was a very different book before. So in what way was it? Did it have different intentions? Or?
I said in the interview.
You said.
Was I saying I've written something and it's?
It's. You said you finished editing it and it has become something else. So, I don't know.
I said that in the interview then?
Yes.
Right, so, Dazed, I got an offer from Quartet on Dazed in the winter of 2008, and it came out the following summer. That winter, I wrote Made in Britain. So you can imagine how far away that is in terms of, I mean, I've had another book out. I've worked on that book and edited it with an editor at a publishing house before I then went back to what it was that winter. So it was three voices. There were three stories, but it was really rough. And I didn't have this kind of clear agenda in terms of where, I knew where I wanted them to end up, but I wasn't entirely sure about how that drama or the tragedies would unfold. So when I left it and went back to it, that's the bit that I had to work on. So why did it become a different book? Because I created plot. Whereas it wasn't plot, it was three voices, and knowing where those three voices ended up. Exactly the same as Alex in Days and Arouse. The difference is, Alex was a vehicle for a very clear statement that I wanted to make, and the world in which he inhabits propped that up. So that was, for me, enough to realise what I wanted to say. That wasn't the case with a coming-of-age novel or a novel about growing up. You can't get away with that, and I didn't want to get away with that. I wanted to write something with real drama and plot, and this is happening, and oh, now this happens. And that took time, because that took time to create and think about and then create other characters who were, like Wadge. I mean, Wadge didn't just come to me. Wadge is, you know, he was who are you? You know, you're just a bit of a nutcase. Not good enough. I needed to come up with something that would pull Charlie away from one set of idiots towards a bunch of really dangerous idiots. And that just took time. And that's why the book at the start is not really anything like that. And yet the voices were always there. So the voices never really changed.
And so, I mean, this is just a hypothetical question.
Yeah.
Unless you have spoken to the youth, as you said. do you think the book will resonate more with people sort of that age who are going through that, or people who, because in my head, hypothetically, I think it's more interesting for people of our age. I don't know. Because it's about, you know, about that thing where, you know, you're looking back on growing up, and it's about that pull. You want to get away from that place really badly. And you can look back at it. It's kind of, but maybe it's easier to read in hindsight because you can look back, and because you have escaped. Most people have.
Yeah.
I don't know, have you had any feedback from sort of younger people who think, you know, who...
There's a book I edited, Coconut Unlimited, by Nikesh Shukla. That is not a gratuitous plug, but it is.
I swear.
I'm going to plug it in we're going to talk about it. Every single book I do, we'll do a podcast, and every single podcast, I will mention Coconut Unlimited by Nikesh Shukla.
That's the excerpt you should read from.
I couldn't do that justice. Nikesh is a great performer. I'd ruin it, I'd butcher it. The thing about that book is that's a coming-of-age novel set in the 90s. So there's all the nostalgia, there's all the kind of what did we do when we were that age stuff, and it's brilliant and it's fun. I've written a book that's about when I was 16. They're 14 in that book, but still, I was 16. In terms of the characters, they're 16, so in my head I'm 16. But I'm growing up now. I didn't set it in the 90s and fill it with a lot of nostalgia. There's no sentimentality in the book. And yet, do you think, not consciously, not, I'm not, you know, I didn't think, oh, I've got, remember that thing we used to do, you know, we used to
have the squares of dairy milk. It's not sentimental at a time period, but like sentimental moments.
Oh, it's definitely sentimental in that sense, but it's not my nostalgia for my bus journey when I used to go to school, or remember those silly Umbro coats we wore that Premier League managers wore, you know, I think all that stuff could have gone in there, but I set it now. And so the nostalgia comes more from my attitude as an author or a person to where I grew up. And I am nostalgic. And when I do go up north, and increasingly over the years since leaving, I become more and more sentimental about the place where I'm from. And I love it more now I've left it. And I'm more protective of it and more fond of it and all the people there than I was when I was 14, 15, 16. And I resented it and I felt trapped and I felt like I was too good for it. I'm going to go down London. And so I did go down London, and now I think, oh, it's actually really nice up there, loads of nice people, and, you know, it might not be right for me right now, but it's where I'm from, it means a lot to me. And that took time and distance to achieve. And so, how did you word your question? Because I've kind of gone off, and then I'm thinking that the nostalgia element is, all about my attitude as an author rather than what actually is in the book. I completely lost my thread.
That's okay.
Get me back, Jonathan Ross. Get me back on track.
Don't call me that.
Why not? What's wrong with Jonathan Ross?
It's so many things.
Michael, Parkinson?
The question was just about whether you think the book resonates more with
young people.
Right.
So it works from that point of view if you're older and you've grown up in a place where you didn't really feel like you belonged and you have a love-hate relationship with home, which is what I put all over the jacket, you know, and that's part of the blurb. That, for me, definitely should resonate if it's a success with people. That's the thing that will make it a success, because they will feel the same love-hate relationship with the place that they're from. They'll see it in my rendering of these characters, hopefully. However, I don't think everyone who reads it will have to have been brought up in a post-industrial town with drug dealers and headless bodies turning up. There'll be people who read this book. Someone's told me only the other day, I didn't know these kids. I have no understanding of these kids. And I actually think that makes it more pertinent to an older reader, because now you've got the riots that have happened recently and the discourse about the feral underclass and all of that. And this kind of, what Owen Jones talks about so well in Chavs, if you've read it, about the demonisation of the working class. We're talking about characters there in Made in Britain that actually the vast majority of people who potentially could buy that book won't know. They won't be familiar with. They think of hoodies. They think of kind of, you know, they don't think of kids with dreams and hopes and complex characters who are a bit rough around the edges, maybe here and there. Some of the places that they're from might be a bit rough around the edges. Not familiar, but still ultimately something you can try and empathise with. So that would make it an adult book. And yet, do I think it would resonate with young people? Well, the feedback I've had so far from people about 18, 19, which granted there's a bit of distance there, is good, is that it really works and it is authentic and it feels right and it doesn't feel forced and it's dark. I'm not convinced that's going to end up on a GCSE syllabus anywhere. You know, I don't imagine people will want to, you know, give 14, 15, 16 year old kids a book about rape and drugs, which ostensibly that book is about, because that's poured in there, that's the content. But yeah, I do think it should resonate with younger people as much as it can with an adult. I mean, they might hate it as much as an adult might hate it, but I think it should. I think it should be okay. I don't think I can imagine me reading a book like that at 16.
When you're 16, you like to read about older people. You don't want to, I don't know, I think you like to, like, it's more aspirational.
It's
like,
too close to home as well. So if I'm growing up in a town, when I was 16, I would not have wanted to read about other teenagers who are actually, even though they're not precocious, I'd still think, no, I wouldn't want that, because I'd think, you know, Charlie. And it's all close to the bone, you know, trying to lose your virginity and that kind of thing, get your head around it. I don't want to read about someone else doing that. I think you want a kind of fantasy view of it. That's why kids watch Skins, right? You know, because life's not really like that, so they watch stuff like that. That's what we all do, don't we? So I think you have to have a bit of distance. So my agent wasn't sure when he was pitching it and we were talking about it, and I knew Quartet were, you know, keen to publish it, and so it didn't really matter in the end anyway. But there was a debate that we had about, do we pitch it as a young adult book? And this could go into the marketing. I mean, it's the same thing. I've never consciously addressed that at all. At no point has the publicist here, you know, said, oh, we really need to tackle the issue of whether kids would like this or not, because it just hasn't come up. And the Observer review, you know, was it never really brought up the idea of whether this is a book aimed at a certain age group. That just never came across. I genuinely haven't had that until the other day when someone sent me an email saying, I think it's a bit more young adult. I thought, surprised, but never mind.
It's a bonus.
Not really bothered. I mean, it's kind of good in a way, because that means it sounds like they're actually young.
Just do another book cover and aim at young people, sell more.
Put a wizard on there or something.
I don't know, maybe not.
A pallid wizard,
I feel like that maybe's been done.
Do you think wizards have been done?
Maybe, I don't know. It's
coming of age novels have been done, haven't they?
Yeah.
Dance of Death, the novel's been done. Let's move on. Let's think of something else.
What would you say to people to sell the book, to make them read it, other than everything?
Or
can we just read the jacket of the book? But I can't see a copy of the book. I don't know what it says on the jacket.
Under there.
I can't see it.
Down there on top of the orange book.
Oh, yeah. See, I don't know what the book looks like, because you're so stingy, I had to read a PDF on my laptop.
You can have that. Honestly, you can have that. Oh, not only because you said that in public, but you can totally have that.
You know
why I sent you a PDF. I sent you a PDF because I didn't want to risk sending you another finished copy of a book by an author whom you detest.
I would have given it as a Christmas present to someone.
Oh, great. I'm very pleased.
Or I'd have sent it back to you.
Well, you can still do that now.
What I was going to say though was,
you can give the PDF.
But that means that's how you know it was a good book and it was moving. That I hate reading stuff on my laptop. So if I read a whole, even if it was a shortish novel, I read the whole thing on my laptop. So it's a good sign. It's a good sign.
I'm really pleased.
Either sell the book to us in your own words, or read off the copy of the book. I'm not going to.
I think you just sold it. I think you sold it then by saying you read it on a laptop and you whizzed through it. I'd say this exactly for the first book as much as the second. That whole thing about why, oh my god, I'm gonna say why I write. Tune into Radio 4.
See, I didn't ask you that question on
no,
purpose.
But why? What is it that I wanted to write each book for? You know, I wanted to write a book that I would like to read, and that I would love. I'd pick up and I'd say, I just want to whiz through this, and I could not put it down. It's unputdownable, a real page turner. And the thing about it is that I really loved writing it. I really loved writing it. I loved being the characters. I loved thinking about them and thinking as them. And I'm really, really fond of them. I'd like to think I've packed enough in that book for anyone to enjoy and to be
shall we read this?
About,
shall we read this bit on the front?
Yeah, I've gone off. I didn't sell it to you then. You got bored, didn't you?
Sorry. Because you've been talking for a
while. I do talk. Yeah, I'm a talker. There's hope for us yet. All right.
Anyway,
I'm
not going to read it now. What was I going to say?
Shall I read what Lee Rourke said? I'll plug Lee Rourke.
But isn't
as well.
He your friend? Isn't that like...
He wasn't. Lee Rourke reviewed Dazed and he loved it. And I'd never met him. And
okay.
I knew that he'd reviewed one book. I'd seen a review of his of a guy called Joe Stretch. Joe Stretch wrote a book called Friction. He's written a couple of others as well. Really talented writer, based up in the north, up in Manchester and Lancaster. I think he's from Kirby Lonsdale, actually, which is near where my mum lives now and where I'm from. Anyway, the point is, he reviewed that book by Joe Stretch, and I just got from the review, there's a chance he might get where I'm coming from with mine. So I kind of took a punt and sent it to him. He loved it. I have since met him and become mates with Lee. So it was really nice of him to say this to the book, but obviously we're in a position now where Lee's not going to be reviewing it left, right, centre, or you know, debating it with me on Newsnight Review or anything like that. He's a mate now. But what he said,
yes,
what Lee Rourke, award-winning author of The Canal, said, and The Canal is brilliant. I'm not saying that because I'm his mate. Again, when I read The Canal, I had only met him in passing. You know, I knew he wrote a good review of my book, but then that doesn't mean I'm going to like his book, right? I mean, what if I hated it? No, it was brilliant. The Canal's awesome. Okay, so he said... how would he say it? He'd say it as a man. Made in Britain reveals the moment in our lives when we begin to shed off our childhood and wait impatiently to become adults. So there you go.
There we go.
That sounded like Nikesh doing an impression of Nick Griffin, but he's actually doing an impression of me. Nikesh can't do accents. He can, but he can't. He does me as a man. And I just did... Lee Rourke as a Yorkshireman. I don't know how I did that.
That
know
was
I did.
Definitely nuanced.
Was it nuanced? Jeez, that's a euphemism, isn't it?
I'm so insincere, I get in trouble for this.
He's going to bollock me for that.
My very last question then. Have you written anything new, or is there anything else in the mix?
Yeah, there's no novel. The idea is percolating for a third novel, whatever that means. So it's not there. It's just a kind of vague idea.
I think you should write a children's book or a young adult.
Do you think
book?
I should get younger and younger? So I wrote for kind of 20-somethings, then I write for teenagers. Now I should write for 9-year-olds.
Write for 9-year-olds, but with landscape.
With landscape. Oh my God.
See if you can get them to read
a 120,000 word.
Something epic.
Epic novel aimed at 9-year-olds, with lots of landscaping. That is obviously on my to-do list. But before I do that, I'm writing a non-fiction book for Zero Books, which is a really cool publisher. And it's about a surrealist artist who was pretty active in the 20s and 30s in Paris and then moved to Jersey and was a resistance fighter in World War II. And when I say resistance, it was her and her partner. They took on the Nazis on Jersey. She died 9 years after the war. Pretty much as a result of being in prison, actually. Her health was never good in her life. She was just extraordinary. Absolutely incredibly brave, courageous, forward-thinking, exciting photographer, but actually mainly a writer and a pretty politically active one. Breton loved her, André Breton. And she was just amazing, but then she was lost. She was lost for decades. People just forgot all about her, and she was not in the history of surrealism. She was just not part of it, as far as art historians were concerned. Then she was kind of refound, and since then there have been a few attempts at trying to kind of contextualise her, feminist points of views, postmodern points of views, but ultimately I just want to get back to the fact that she's awesome, and I want to write a pretty short kind of part biography, but part polemic about how awesome she is and why everyone should know who she is. And she's called Claude Cahan, if you're going to try and do it in French, or Claude Gahun, if you're going to say, as Lee Rourke, as Nikesh, as Nick Griffin.
I look forward to it. See, I'm trying really hard not to speak today.
No, it's good. Keep it up.
But then you keep talking, and now we've gone over 41 minutes. So
have we?
I'm
what time
say
is it now?
It's 40. You've still got time to leave, though.
It's a good time. It's a good time to wrap.
Yes. So thank you very much for your time again, and for the
you're welcome
copy of Maiden Britain,
pleasure
which
to
everyone
do it again.
Should read.
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Great.